That's what I want to talk about a little bit tonight. And actually, in saying that, I'm aware that I might be able to actually distill some of the things that came out of that five-day event and bring it out here in a kind of distilled or summarized form. The wording that I'm using about direct experience, we can recognize immediately that our sensory experience, our experience of sense contact, is a direct experience. There is no separation between the object of sound and the ear door that hears the sound. There's no separation between the object of sight and the eye door. There's no separation between the object of smell and the nose, the object of taste and the tongue. Yeah? And watch this. The object of tactile, or you could say physical sensation. And what? Now I'm going to make a little shift. Awareness. Okay, so backing up there, the eyes do not see their respective objects or object of sight without a... Oh, thank you, Libby. How'd you know to do that?
I didn't have it with me.
I was going to ask you. I wish I could share it with you. Sorry. Pass it around. That would get weird. Now, that's a little contact, huh? Some people would go like this. Some people just go, phew. Some people go, I'm not drinking that. I'm into connectedness, but not that much. I don't want your germs. So, the nature of our mind includes conceptualization. And until we recognize how concepts can filter or color or label, describe, sometimes more effectively than others, the direct experience of life, until we recognize this, we can be somewhat vulnerable to our concepts. In a sense, I'm going to just put my hand here, coming in between, yeah, let's say the object of hearing and the ear door, the word about the sound, even the word, say, oh, that's a beautiful bird sounding, that's a beautiful bird song. If we're not careful, those words start to come in between and filter and even suggest a separation between, in this case, just sticking with the simple example, the object of sight and the organ, or you might say profound mechanism it sees. Okay, so just consider the sense organs right now, right? And notice that most of them are in the head, in the area of the head. Now, what makes those sense organs, you might say, animated, isn't just something that science has gotten way inside and continue to get way inside, describe how these senses work, but the faculty, yeah, the nature would be a better word, of awareness itself. So, we have concepts about almost everything, because that's how we describe our world, is through concepts. And if I'm not careful, those concepts begin to enter into my direct experience of life in such a way that they suggest and even generate a sense of reality in the word or concept that actually isn't there in the way that the mind at times begins to perceive. For example, someone named you something like Doug or Paul. This is not Paul, and that is not Doug. That's a label, that's a name, that's a concept. This was described by some at some point as a male body. This is a female body. This is a concept. Old body, young body. Pleasant feelings, unpleasant feelings. That's a very subtle one. Good feelings, bad feelings. Desirable things, undesirable things. If we don't recognize the power of conditioning born through the action or function of concepts, these concepts begin to suggest that this world that we live in is divided up into the things that these words point towards. Whereas in reality, or in actuality, everything is interconnected. Now, you could go to science and say, okay, yeah, sure. 20 years ago or 15 years ago, they started to recognize this interconnectedness. You could read all about that. You'd just be having concepts in your mind. It's just fine. And they're interesting concepts, and sometimes they feel true. They feel real. But as you begin to drop into what, I'm going to use the word, feels true, sensed as true, these concepts become less and less important. You still use them, but they don't have to come in the same way and suggest the same thing that they've done. Because what happens at times is the mind becomes attached to those concepts. For example, notice how attached, we'll stick with American culture right now, notice how attached American culture, not all of it, but certain aspects of it, notice how attached the culture is to youth. To not aging, which is against the law of nature. It's natural for the body to age. It's natural for the body to die. It's natural for the brain, watch this one, it's natural for the brain to just become less and less organized. And if this starts to happen too soon, you know, I'm having a pre sort of Alzheimer's moment. Or as one person in the grocery store the other day who I hadn't seen in many years, "How you doing?" I said to him. And he kind of, and I said, "Hey, have you seen this product here?" And he was kind of going like this, and he said, "Hey, just bear with me, I'm having a senior moment." Mm-hmm. So I kid about that stuff. Senior moment, non-senior moment. These words, if not careful, the considered, these concepts lay in over reality. And what happens when they lay in over reality enough? We lose our childlike wonder. Regardless of our gender, regardless of our age, our birthright is to live in a kind of childlike wonder. It doesn't need to figure anything out. It doesn't need to understand anything. It doesn't need to go anywhere. It doesn't need to be different. It doesn't need to be better. It doesn't need to change. That's free and open as it is. And this is what conceptualization can do. It doesn't have to, but it can do this. It can shroud, cover, veil. It can put some nice yellow Florida tree pollen right over the top. Anybody in this room waiting for the tree pollen to dissipate a little bit? Anybody been waiting for that? Anybody in this room like, "Wow, I love this stuff." You can get a kind of different sensation if you breathe in enough. It's amazing. It's just falling out of the trees. Pollen, the word, is a concept. The direct experience of pollen is this sensation, and it varies for all of us. Some people aren't affected at all. Other people are completely, well, not completely, but largely stuffed up right now. And they're taking drugs for it, and they're miserable for it, they're not sleeping well for it, and they're contemplating, perhaps at this very moment as we sit here, "You know, I might have to leave Florida. I just can't take this stuff. I might have to go to a different place. I met a guy like that. He couldn't stand the molds around this place. And there's more molds here than there are in, like, New England because of the humidity." So we either begin to really enter more and more deeply our environment, like we were entered into when we were children, before we thought about ourselves as men, women, before we had a self-concept or an idea that, well, maybe I'm not okay. Maybe I need to be different. You know, maybe I need to be faster. Maybe I need to da-da-da-da-da, whatever. Maybe I'm not okay. Before any of that arose. And by the way, if you've never wondered whether you're okay or not, there's only two possible ways to look at that. Okay, you're either in denial or you're free. Got a third possibility? It's going to go one way or the other. Now, here's the piece on denial. Denial is a tendency in the conditioned mind to discard, or in an emotional sense, disavow certain experiences because they're unwanted, they're unpleasant. Missing, right, that the inherent nature of all experience, including the ones that the mind judges or compares as less desirable, unpleasant, all of those experiences by nature move just like the tree pollen. Ever-changing, completely not solid, and not who we are, in essence, not who we are fundamentally. So sometimes in the meditation, the idea arises or the feeling arises that I would like to change this experience. I would like to not have this experience. I would like to have other experiences. You're splitting life up. Life comes in all shades and all colors, and all shapes and all textures. And the magic, or the mystery of it, is that it continually is ever changing in a way. It's never exactly the same in any instant. The conceptual mind, which is a conditioned mind, believes that life is happening progressively and it's linear. The only thing linear going on in this room right now, and it's a perception, is your thinking mind. Everything else is unfolding in a non-linear wholeness or a non-linear completeness. Okay, for example, would anybody say this room that we're sitting in is not whole as itself? Okay, does anybody see this room? And don't go in the back over there by the kitchen, because that's the kitchen, okay? Something else is going on back there. But in this room that can be seen with the eyes right now, okay, just right in here. Would anybody say this room is not whole as itself? And you say, well, this room is like segmented, it's divided, it likes that half better than this half. Or that part is better than that part. Like, is this part better than this part, even though it's higher up? So this room then, nobody's saying no to this, so this room then, we could agree, is whole as itself, right? Okay, is this bottle with the water whole, complete as itself? Or this recorder, or this clock, or this stick, whole as itself? Fair enough? Okay, I don't see you like jumping all over this, like, yeah, or no, okay? So you're just subdued, maybe. How come we don't feel whole? Because we believe we're not. Have you ever wondered why you believe you're not whole? Why you might believe you're not complete as you are? And one of the answers to that question for some people is because of how they feel. They have feelings that suggest to them, wait a minute, this isn't part of wholeness, this isn't part of how I'd like to be. Why is that? Because I have a concept about how I'd like to be. And if I have a concept about how I'd like to be, then I'm going to be somewhat threatened, or you could say split, between that and what? Concepts of how at times I'm being. Which could come through as feelings, it could come through as thoughts, it could come through as bodily sensations, could come through as perceptions, could come through as imaginations, could come through as memories, could come through in all of those different shapes and textures, because that's how life is. The reason why we're already free is because we're already whole and complete as we are. Now, some people go, well, that's a nice idea, but I don't feel that. And it doesn't make a lot of difference for me to just think that's the case or take that on as a belief. So what to do? Well, first we have to recognize clearly, and this is what meditation's for, is to help us recognize, not just think about, but see directly, experience directly, that which appears to divide me, that which appears to divide me. And what I'm pointing at right now is that which appears to divide me, perhaps most powerfully, is ideas and concepts. The fundamental idea and concept that appears to divide me is my concepts of who I think I am. My self-concepts. Now, human beings don't just have self-concepts. They have identification with self-concepts. They have attachment or aversion to self-concepts. They have other self-concepts that they feel would be more suitable for them than the concept that they actually find in their mind. Like some people are completely comfortable with the concept of a male body. They're so comfortable with it, they don't even think about it. Hardly ever think about it. Have you noticed this? Like a child who's busy just, the little boy, he's so busy being a boy, he's not considering, hey, I'm a boy. I mean, at some point he might. Let me give you a different example. I know a little boy, he's 4 years old, his name is Miles. Now, Miles is into his name. He loves to say it, and he likes the first letter a lot, M. M for Miles. It's the most important letter, probably, to him. And when he goes by McDonald's, big M, that's me, baby. He's into... There's a self-concept coming through, and he's digging it. He's way inside it, man. And when he gets with other kids, he rules the roost. He's like a CEO in the play. I mean, he's moving and he's doing. When he comes to my house, he takes over. I mean, I let him to a certain extent, and that's sort of a limit. So you think, oh, Miles is into himself. Miles is self-absorbed. Miles is separate from everything else. No, watch this one. Take him to a soccer game. Get up there in the stands with everybody, and there's the, you know, popcorn. You want to get popcorn when you go to the soccer game if they're serving. So we get the bag of popcorn. What does Miles do? Instead of eating the whole thing himself, which some kids might do, his first interest and passion, I might add, is to walk through the stands and share popcorn with people. So he's given one to this person and two to that person, and then this one he decides to give three to. And some people are like, wow, they just open right up. Thank you. And other people are like, I'm watching the game. Who's this kid? Somebody should be tending him. I mean, I'm imagining these thoughts because I'm not in their head. Their face is not looking happy. Do you know what I'm talking about? I mean, some people can be happy and their face can be all like Scroogey. But these people, some of them were like, hey, you know, just don't bother me, kid. And he's like, generous. Giving. So the self-concept, at some point, in the nature of awakening, which is what meditation's about, it has to be faced. Because until you face that, until you see that, until you recognize that, non-judgmentally, you will not see its nature. You will not see the nature of the self-concept. And the nature of the self-concept is the same as everything else. It comes and it goes. There's no solidity in any self-concept. Plus, if you don't see through those self-concepts, you will think and believe and defend at times even that you are that. And that will divide you. That will separate you. That will separate you from other people. That will separate you within yourself. That will even separate you from your environment. Which is a tremendous tragedy, to be feeling separate from the natural world, which is so benevolent, even when it gets a little rocky and rough, like it did just recently in Japan. That's profound. we're going to be learning from that for a long time. Libra and I were talking about that today, learning from that for a long time. The layers of learning that will come from that power of nature. And how are we to implicate ourselves? Because it's all interconnected. So, instead of viewing concepts as a problem or something to get rid of, which is wrong view, not that it is wrong versus right, but it's unskillful in the sense that if all of my self-concept was in my right big toe, and spiritual awakening was about eliminating self-concepts, that would be analogous to cutting off my toe. And I don't think I want to do that. Do you? It's part of the nature of what we are to have concepts. The shift, that's a huge shift, that can happen very, very deeply and very, very, in some senses, completely, so immediate. In most cases, it seems like there's a progressive thinning of the identification with concepts, holding them against other concepts, higher and lower concepts, better or worse concepts, adjustment of concepts. Let me get to a better self-concept. Meanwhile, what meditation does is bit by bit, like the light of the sun, it penetrates into those concepts and begins to distill and ultimately dissolve them. And what happens is those self-concepts dissolve, or rather their nature is seen as not solid, then thoughts become much more friendly to have. Much more enjoyable to have a thinking experience. See, meditation then doesn't mean I'm trying to get rid of my thoughts and not have thoughts and just have a silent mind, which is a wonderful thing, to be completely silent. When this thing turns off like an AC compressor, what's here? Peace and tranquility. But every state comes and goes, so if that peace and tranquility comes, a little or a lot, and that is what it's all about, baby, then you're going to be threatened by what follows it. The more your investment in any experience, equal proportion will be the disappointment when that experience dissolves, and every experience dissolves. When I use the word experience right now, to be very precise, I'm talking about what comes and goes. Relativity, what comes and goes. So instead of trying to get rid of the concepts like cutting off my toe, what I can do is I can begin to recognize their own particular, you might say, expression. I can actually open up to them. I can get curious about them. I can get interested in recognizing them as teachers. And what that does is it begins to decentralize their tendency in the conditioned mind to want to be in the driver's seat. So if you want to think of self-concept now in a collected form as a personality, you could do that. If you want to think about a certain grouping of traits or attitudes as part of the personality, you could do that. But it's made up of the sensory experience, the emotional experience, the mental experience, the perceptual experience, and the consciousness experience. These things intertwine to form what you call, or what some people call, myself. So someone brought something to my attention at the end of the residential event that was very interesting. In recognizing that there's a going back into relationship, because when you're in retreat, you're there together, but you stop talking, so you're not socializing, and you really, really give yourself the space to get deep in your meditation. But then as they come out, for some people, then they begin to think about relationships again, and I've got to go back, and sometimes issues come up again about, oh boy, what about this? And sometimes the issue of boundaries arises. So the person says to me, Paul, if there's no self, then what about boundaries? And the thing to recognize is that whether there's a self or there is no self is not a particularly useful thing to spend a lot of time in trying to figure out with your brain. Because number one, you're not going to be able to do, especially that half that deals with the so-called no self. There's no way you can figure that out with your brain.
conceptually. You can experience that there is no solidity of self in a direct, you might say, insight. And that what you've been calling yourself, the ever-changing process of unfolding elements or energy, if you will, this makes sense. However, the mind, in this particular person's case, was trying to figure out, well, if there's no self, then how do you have boundaries? And should you have boundaries? And where do you have boundaries? And who do you have boundaries with? And so automatically there was some confusion present. Okay, so the thing to recognize is, if you hear teachings about there isn't any self, or the self is empty, there was no self, the point is to recognize that there is no self. You can read the Buddhist teachings. The heart of the teachings is the recognition of anatta, which is a Pali word. Pali is a language that's similar to Sanskrit, only more for the common people. That there isn't any enduring self. Well, the only way that makes any sense for a human is they need to have direct insight into that. So trying to figure that out conceptually is actually just beating around the bush. However, dealing with boundaries and relationship, I need to know where my yeses and my noes are. I need to know where my yeses and my noes are, especially if I'm in front of a salesman. I need to know where my yeses and my noes are when people are asking me to do things, or I'm asking them to do things. If I don't know where my yeses and my noes are, I'm going to bring a certain amount of confusion into that interpersonal field. And we know how much difficulty happens between human beings relationally. You can spend a lot of your life working out a process called being in relationship with other human beings. And you can get trapped there. And your mind process can be involved in it, your emotional process, your physical process. You can feel entrapped. Am I making sense? It's not just about attachment. It's about confusion. Okay, it's about not seeing clearly the nature of that, in a way, relatively speaking, the bodies are separate in this room. They can be distinguished, that's a better word. Yeah? But in the nature of reality, or in the nature of being or wholeness, nothing is separate from anything else. These two things I just said are not contradictory. They're mutually interdependent. And by the way, everything, by the way, is mutually interdependent. We're mutually interdependent with H2O. And our connection to the earth through food and the sun, etc. So, the notion, yeah, or you could say the consideration or the possibility in meditation is, instead of coming into this with some ideation or concept about what to do, how to do it, and what's supposed to happen if I do such and such, the possibility is available in any instant, and that's how life happens, instant by instant. Those instances linked together are called progressive time in the linear mind. That's just a perception. So you could sit in a kind of an innocence, a Miles-like popcorn openness, because that's what he was all about that day, all about the openness and the generosity of sharing the popcorn with anybody who was open to it, and some people weren't. Some people were. And then experience, which, by the way, experience is free as itself already. It's not going to become free later. It is free as itself already, is being itself freely as it is right now. And everything that's happening right now is that for every human being. That doesn't mean that that's how it's perceived. Tell that to somebody in Japan who was born in the house that they're now standing on, the shattered, just shattered base, foundation, not even a foundation. And the man says, my great-grandfather built this house. My grandfather lived in this house. My father and I was born in this house. Now it's gone. Not a nice time to tell somebody it's all impermanent. Impermanence is totally 100% reliable. That's not a morbid, pessimistic truth. That's the actuality. And when we line up, you could say, with that sense of change and impermanence, it becomes very, very friendly. And instead of it being something to be unhappy or sad about, it wakes your life up more and more and more and more and more. It liberates you, so to speak, into this. And we call this present moment. It's a concept. Show me the present. Where's the present? I'll put my finger on the present. Where's the present? Where's the moment? Where's the now? These are all subtle concepts. The idea that I am going to practice being present. This is one that came out on the retreat. The idea that I am going to practice being present. Presence awareness sees the idea that I am going to practice being present. There is no I that practices being present except a conceptual idea in the brain. That's all the I is. That's an incredibly simple statement. But to see through this conception of I, this investment in I, that runs right down through this thing and says, this is the I, this is me. And don't mess with me. This is me. Don't disagree with me. Don't hurt me. We have no idea what we're really talking about until we look closely and see, what is this me, I? So I hope it's clear that this isn't about trying to get rid of anything, nor is it about trying to fixate upon certain things and keep those things around and make them last, because you can't do it. And when you see this for yourself clearly, then the mind, you could say, or whatever it is in here that tends to hold on, and you can find it for yourself if you look. That's why the body is so fantastically cool. It just shows where there's holding. I don't know why the body sometimes hurts in meditation, because those spots are where the mind's holding. It may be where you ate too much too, or something like that. But it's where the body, mind, where clinging is happening. And you can see this for yourself. I used to contemplate this. I go, wow, did this come about randomly, or was this designed? Like, was there an intelligence that designed this? Is this Brahman? Is this God? That breathed into this form, this sensitivity. There's a beautiful passage. I'll close with this, and we'll see what those, perhaps from the retreat, want to share first, and then we'll open up to the whole group. This is from the Upanishads. Can you hear me, Robert?
You're a little bit low.
Little low, okay, thank you. It's called Akina. It's a certain part of the Upanishads, and by the way, the Upanishads historically are some of the oldest so-called divinely inspired, that's what a spiritual text is. It's a divinely inspired text. It's different than Dave Barry's comic strip, which is also at times deeply profound when he says there's a fine line between hobbies and mental illness. In the Kina of Upanishad, very, very beautiful passage, it goes like this. Not that which the eye sees, but that whereby the eye sees. Know this, and this alone, to be Brahman, the eternal, not what people here adore, not that which the ear hears, but that whereby the ear can hear. Know this, and this alone, to be Brahman, the eternal, not what people here adore. Not that the body breathes, but that whereby the body can breathe. Know this, and this alone, to be Brahman, the eternal, not what people here adore. And it goes on through the anatomy of experience, really, describing each of the experiences that we have, and shows through language, if we're ready to see that, because concepts can point beyond concepts. That's what a koan is about. That's what a pointing out instruction in meditation is about. The word is used to pierce through the conceptual mind, open into the spaciousness out of which everything arises. And that spaciousness that everything is abiding in. See the difference? not that which the eye sees, because if you're not careful, you get enthralled with experiences, wonderful experiences here on planet Earth. All kinds of ups and downs, colors and shapes. They all come and they go. Now it says, not that which the eye sees, but that whereby the eye can see. Consider this. Some people call that source, I don't. And it's not in Nikinan Upanishad either, the word source is not there. That whereby the eye can see, one word that might work is an intelligence beyond anything comprehensible allows this to function. I rest my case right now in the mystery. It's mysterious, it's unfathomable, it's incomprehensible. And the reality is we are that already. The shift in awakening and if spiritual practice works, it shifts the human perception from the belief, illusion, that suggests the world is divided, a little or a lot, out into an openness of, you could say, view that shows it's all absolutely fine just the way it is. You don't need to throw divine on top if you don't want to, but you could. It doesn't need a change, and yet it will. And there is the timeless, the mysterious timeless that's present here as that which is seeing everything. So what it is then, and I'll conclude with this, what it is a shift into what's already happening that has not yet been recognized. Not becoming something other than what I perceive myself to be. That's really not the best way to describe it, nor does it work like that. So for some people, it's like they fall open, or they almost fall backwards into the recognition that what they're looking for is what they already are. And the silence, very, very wonderful aid for assisting in the insights. Because if we stay too busy, too involved, and certainly the risk of being driven, we're just filling the space with activity. And it's a rare person who can be completely active and busy all the time and have deep insight into the nature of reality simultaneously. Getting quiet, settling, does make sense. It's not absolutely mandatory. It just helps for many people. Okay. So anybody from the event, Mary, thanks for coming.